Hello, and welcome to this week's Ukraine Calling program. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. We'll have a roundup of the weekly news for you, some culture and some music. We're bringing you a feature interview with former Ukrainian Minister of Education and President of the Kyiv Mohyla Academy National University, Serhii Kvit. But first, as always, the news. On the 18th of November, the State Security Service of Ukraine, SBU, announced that 8 Georgian nationals had been deported for allegedly posing a threat to Ukraine's national security. They were all linked to Georgia's former president, Mikhail Saakashvili, who has become an outspoken critic of Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, and is attempting to create a political movement to replace the current Ukrainian leadership. During the week, concern about the legality and apparent political motivation behind the expulsions was voiced by, among others, Ukraine's parliamentary ombudsperson and the US State Department. Last week, Belarus confirmed the arrest of a Ukrainian journalist, Pavlo Sharoyko, and subsequently declared a Ukrainian diplomat persona non grata. On the 21st of November, Ukraine responded by expelling a Belarusian diplomat. This latest development has further strained bilateral relations. On the 21st of November, the fourth anniversary of the start of the Euromaidan protests in Kyiv that developed into the Revolution of Dignity, was observed in Ukraine as the Day of Dignity and Freedom. In the middle of the week, an armed coup was launched in the Russian-backed separatist so-called People's Republic of Luhansk by a faction led by its self-styled Minister of the Interior, Igor Kornet. He refused to step down after being dismissed by local strongman Igor Plotnitsky and, after apparently receiving decisive military support from Russia and the neighboring allied breakaway region calling itself the Donetsk People's Republic, was able to force his former chief to flee to Moscow. It remains unclear why Plotnitsky was ousted at this stage and what it implies. In Kyiv, in response to the concentration of Russian forces precipitated by the feuding among the separatists, President Poroshenko convened an emergency meeting of the Military Office of the National Security and Defense Council. Some units of the Ukrainian armed forces are reported to have made use of the confusion in Luhansk to regain several settlements along the front line, but with the loss of several soldiers. In the meantime, more arrests of Crimean Tatar activists have been made in Russian-occupied Crimea. An 82-year-old veteran Crimean Tatar activist, Vedzhe Kashka, was reported by Ukraine's Foreign Minister Pavlo Klimkin to have died of the stress during the detentions. On the 23rd of November, President Poroshenko met in Brussels with the President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, ahead of the Eastern Partnership Summit scheduled for the following day. He expressed gratitude to President Tusk for, quote, the absolutely clear, solid and consistent position of support for Ukraine's European aspirations and sanctions against Russia as a consequence of Russia's aggression against Ukraine, unquote. President Poroshenko also refuted media reports that had claimed he had considered cancelling his Brussels visit because of apparent growing frustration with Kyiv's pace of reforms, and that in fact this time the results from the Eastern Partnership Summit for Ukraine would be rather disappointing. The declaration issued by the summit on Friday referred to Ukraine's European choice and aspirations to join the EU. But it was also stated that the time had arrived to discuss bilaterally the progress being made in implementing the reforms connected with becoming associate partners of the EU. In the war in eastern Ukraine, heavy fighting broke out in the Luhansk sector after the coup in the separatist stronghold, particularly on the 23rd of November around Krymsk, resulting in the loss of 4 Ukrainian soldiers and 2 being wounded. A 5th Ukrainian soldier was also killed elsewhere. Ukrainian troops have reportedly reclaimed several villages in the area of Svitlodarsk salient.
Hello, I'm Marta Dychak for Hromadske Radio Ukraine Calling. With us today, we have a special guest, Dr. Serhii Kvit, who is a professor of journalism at the National University of the Kyiv-Mohyla Academy Journalism School, which he set up. And he did such a good job with the journalism school that he got promoted and became the president of the National University of the Kyiv-Mohyla Academy, and did such a good job with that that he was then asked to be Ukraine's education minister. Currently, Dr. Kvit is a Fulbright scholar at Stanford University, where he's there for an academic year. Dr. Kvit, thank you very much for finding the time to speak to us. Could you please tell our listeners what is the purpose of your visit to Stanford? What project are you working on? How do you want to use the experience that you'll get at Stanford to enrich Ukraine's higher education, journalism education?
Thank you, Marta, and hello for all our listeners. You know that Stanford University gives a lot of different opportunities for me. And first of all, I'm going to finish the second edition of my textbook, Mass Communications. It means, first of all, it's different, media issues. It is really what I'm interested in. The second point is I would like to understand how American Independent Center works and how they influence the public rhetoric and decision-making process in the United States. I mean university independent centers and such centers like Brookings Institute, Carnegie Foundation, and some similar centers. That is why I think I will have enough time for all of for all these tasks. And I would like also mention for illustration how I can spend my time at Stanford University. Maybe on the second or the third day when I came at Stanford, I had the opportunity to meet with former CIA director. Oh. And it was a really interesting seminar off records.
What was the topic?
Yeah. And it's interesting, to ask such person thinks about Ukraine, about international politics, and it was really, really interesting for me.
Since it was off the record, I can't ask you what he said, but what sort of insight, you've worked in Ukrainian government, you've worked as a minister of education, and now you had a chance to meet with and speak with an American high-level official. What's the difference in the tone or the content of the what you saw?
You know that there is one really big difference. In U.S., the system works, first of all. And the system is very helpful for any state official. And, of course, any state official has a special responsibility for his or her decision and for politics itself, but the system is very helpful. This is the difference between U.S. and Ukraine, first of all.
How can you use that knowledge to try to implement changes in Ukraine?
As I mentioned, I want to understand how such independent centers work. It's about, first of all, political science. I think that we need to change the decision-making process in Ukraine because we need do it more professional. Our state officials need more reliable information. I think that in the future, maybe not only civil society will be leader, in different changes, but our politicians and our state officials will be more proactive and will be more professional, especially in this decision-making process. I think we have to change the process, how we are finding the most important solutions for our problems. We have a problem with process itself.
Where
very
does
often
that,
it looks very post-Soviet. Yeah.
Mm. Where do you see the role of academia and intellectuals in perhaps improving the policymaking process? If I understood, that's what you're interested in.
Yeah, of course. We have, unfortunately, in Ukraine, very often we have a big gap between activity of our state officials and activity of our intellectuals and academia, because our state officials maybe in our time have more close relations to activity of our politicians, and very often it's they don't have any imagination about the topics what they are talking about and what they have a deal with. That is why I think we should found more technological ways how our intellectuals and Ukrainian academicians can collaborate and even influence to the activity of state officials and change it in a more appropriate and more professional way. And one of the important point of my activity as a visiting scholar at Stanford University is to understand how it works in the United States. And this is a civil society, from time to time organizes some kind of pressure to the government, and the government have to implement something, but
they're pushing them to make changes, but where does
changes,
the expertise to,
instance,
to make informed decisions? Where does
I have one example related to our law on high education, and
that you participated in drafting.
Right. That it was implemented. It was actually approved by our parliament in 2014 and previously for two previous years. Our academic community prepared the text of this draft law, the text of this new law. And the problem is that, even we have the difference between Ukrainian and English language, how we use such terms, in English language, we have the synonyms that we can use the word approve. Parliament approves the law or implements the law. It's the same. But in Ukraine, the case of approvement is a big difference from the case of implementation, because we could have some new and very progressive law without any serious implementation. That is why we have a lot of things which we can borrow from the American or North, if you want, North American system, how we should work more professionally and more seriously on the development of our country.
One of the areas that you have a lot of expertise in is in journalism, communications, and mass media. What sort of expertise do you think the current Ukrainian government could use to improve, whether it's legislation or implementation of laws regarding freedom of speech?
Oh, that it's also interesting point that post-Soviet area has own specific and some interesting, own peculiarities and features. Very often in Ukraine, it's more important to change practice than even change the legislation, because practice very often is something much more important and influential than implementation.
So how do you change the practice?
Yeah, but in Ukraine, the practice, especially in media, is changing by media, by active journalists, and by civil society. And very often, this part of of professional community very often, fortunately, I think, don't need any advice or any new laws. But at the same time, I think that we have quite good situation in media. And of course, we still have different manipulative practices related to the activity of our politicians, media owners, non-professional journalists. But at the same time, our society and our journalist community are very active. That is why we really have freedom of speech in Ukraine.
So if I understood you correctly, the changes in Ukraine have come from below, from journalists who've pushed change. And we're now living in a world where fake news and post-truth is something that is a global phenomenon. Perhaps Ukraine and Ukrainian journalists have something not so much to learn but to teach other countries that are just encountering this phenomenon.
Yeah, but sometimes, some other countries can borrow and can get something from Ukrainian experience. And I would like to mention some very important projects in media sphere in Ukraine. First of all, it's about Stop Fake, which was established at Kyiv-Mohyla School of Journalism. And the second one, Ukrainian Crisis Media Center, which was established at the same time in March 2014. And both of these projects are very influential. And how they work, I think sometimes it's really could be as examples for other our partners. It means sometimes we can show how we can work quite professionally.
For our listeners who might not know about these projects, could you just very briefly describe Stop Fake does?
A Stop Fake project was established at Kyiv-Mohyla School of Journalism just after the Revolution of Dignity. It was the March of 2014. This is a fact-checking project. It works in 11 languages. And we collaborate with different partners around the world, especially among journalists, public activists. And this project was established by teachers, students, and graduates of our School of Journalism. And that is why, because this project works in 11 languages, everyone can go to the internet and look at how it works.
And what does it do? What's the purpose?
Well, the purpose, fact-checking project. It means that we can try to help both Ukrainian and the different international public to understand what's going on, first of all, in case of Ukrainian-Russian undeclared war, because it's not the war only against Ukraine from side of Putin's regime, but it's in fact it's the war which started by Putin's regime against the West itself. And by the way, at Stanford University last week we had very interesting presentation of one scholar from Belgium, and he in a very interesting manner explained us what kind of rhetoric uses by Putin in and his guys. By the way, what is the history according to Putin? What is the history as a subject? What is this? It's just history of the struggle of Russia against the West. And this is, notion of history, according to Putin. And I like one more idea, that according to Putin personally, Ukraine is considered as a part of the West. I think it's a really great achievement of all our revolutions here.
So Ukraine has developed this expertise in fact-checking to counter fake news that's coming out of Russia about what's going on in Ukraine. How can this be helpful to journalists in the United States? We have a president sitting in Washington who constantly says fake news, fake news. So how can this be useful for journalists in the States?
The most dangerous part of such activity, like creating of fake news, is the final goal of such activity. But the final goal, if we are looking at the activity of Putin and Putin's regime, they are creating of fake media reality. It means, in comparison to previous regimes like totalitarian Soviet Union, in that case we had we had wrong interpretations, but of real facts. But today, we don't have. We are not speaking about real facts. Only fake facts, fake news. And in Russia, they are very successful. And in Russia, they created, in fact, a fake media reality. And it means the final goal of such activity is very, very dangerous. And, of course, Western countries, you know, they have only from time to time fake news from Russia Today, for instance. Yeah. But final goal is domination and invasion and aggression from Russia. That is why, you know, it's so serious for everyone today because we are living in the global world.
This is an opinion question, so you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. But I'm very interested what your opinion is about relations between Russia and the United States in the context of fake news. There's a lot of information that's being put in the public sphere that this happened or denial of what happened. What is your opinion about that relationship?
You know, I think sometimes we can, you know, it would be better that we will use not Russia itself, but maybe Putin's regime. It would be better, you know, because very often we have some contacts with our Russian colleagues who today don't have any opportunity to show their opinion because of fake media reality in Russia. But I think it's a very serious question. And Putin's regime tries to influence on everything around the world. And I believe seriously that they try to, you know, to change the public opinion of Americans in time of the last presidential election. They tried to change the opinions of British citizens in time of voting for or against Brexit. They tried to influence on public opinion of France or maybe Germany or all European countries when they have some elections or, you know, some kind of... elections, or they try to understand what their white public would like to change within the country. And it's very serious, I think, and we should be, you know, we should be active in such activity. Like, first of all, the first step is... you know, fact-checking, it's very perspective. Also, from other point of view, because fact-checking is the activity for the strengthening of professional media, because professional media, professional journalists try to work, you know, with a high level of responsibility, you know, in front, you know, to their public. That is why it's very serious, I think.
Yeah, but professional journalism is is under threat, I would suggest, in many countries.
So. Yeah.
For financial reasons, for this sort of post-truth.
Right.
Do you see that Ukraine will be consulted by journalists in countries like Canada, like the United States, like Britain, since Ukrainians have been on the receiving end of this activity and I think have developed models of withstanding and exposing this?
Yeah. And sometimes we can speak about exchanging our, you know, some our experiences and some good examples because, you know, Ukraine, in fact, is in the front line against such threats, what we are talking about. And sometimes we can borrow from U.S., from Canada, from Western Europe, from Australia maybe. But sometimes I think our Western partners also would be interesting to borrow something from our experience because we are front line and we are protecting of our independence in different fields.
So exchange of experience, going both ways.
Right.
So learning and sharing.
Right.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Dr. Serhii Kvit, professor of journalism at the National University of the Cave Muhila Academy, current Fulbright scholar at Stanford University. I'm Marta Dechok for Hromadske Radio. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much.
Now moving on to culture. Donbas Think Tank released a short film this week on the 20th of November, Tuesday. On that day, exactly 100 years ago, a blue and yellow Ukrainian flag was raised in the town of Bakhmut. That's in the Donetsk Oblast. On that day, amidst revolutionary activities, Ukraine's Central Rada issued the Third Universal. It designated Ukraine's territory and declared a federal relationship with Russia. The film uses archival footage and photographs and reminds viewers that one of the co-authors of this historic document was Mikita Shapoval, who was in fact from Bakhmut. The message of the film is simple. The Donbas is and historically has been part of Ukraine. We'll post a link to the film and the NGO's website on our show's page. And now, music. Well, there's a band called Next Stone in Kramatorsk, which is also in the Donetsk Oblast. They recently released a song in English called Imperfect. Although the English is also imperfect, the vocalist sounds a bit like Bonnie Tyler. Enjoy.
You know my nature like nobody does. You explore me, and I can never go back to the state where I was. I feel you're my revelation. I don't wanna wake up. You've been mean, and I might be crazy, but I don't want you to stop. What kind? Keep standing with my cold feet on the edge of your lies with you there, collecting all things that I've had sacrificed. From my summer theory, I don't want to wake up. You've been cruel, but I'm crawling for more, and I don't want you to stop.
Thanks for listening to our latest installment of Ukraine Calling for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. We'll be on the air again next week, and we will bring you the same recipe of news, current events, an in-depth interview, and music and culture. This is Bohdan Nahailo from Hromadske Radio. Stay tuned next week for a new program.